Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenas tardes. Hello and welcome to episode 2 of this current series of podcasts by Trademark Belfast, joined once again by comrade Stuart McGill and Sean Byers from Trademark. Last time we met, we were going through a series of questions that listeners had sent us in about things they were interested to learn about in this series on the stock market, or the capital markets, to call it its proper names, I suppose. And we went through a few last time. We've got another couple of questions here we want to talk about today. Each of these questions will probably, I think, end up being a separate podcast or even a couple of podcasts, because as Stuart said last week, they're very big topics. And as Sean reminded us, there's an awful lot of history and background to get our heads around, to understand the development of capitalism over the last 250 years. And the very fact that some elements of capitalism have been with us actually for 700 or 800 years in terms of bond markets and debt markets and so on. So we've got a lot to delve into. We'll take our time. We're not doing anything else. We're going to sit here for half an hour and have a chin wag. The first question that we finished last time, and there was a question that was coming up next, and I'm going to go to you on this one first, Sean. And someone was asking, particularly because of the week that's in it, with the IPCC report coming out last week there, and the temperature in some Syracuse, I think it was in Sicily, hit 48.8 degrees, the hottest ever temperature recorded in Europe. And yet at the same time, I remember you sent me something, Sean, about 18 months ago, and it was a report that BP or Shell or one of the big companies had presented to its own shareholders. And the report said in it that they were planning that their investment strategy would help the globe towards 5 degrees warming from pre-industrial levels, i.e. they went into their shareholders and said, our current strategy for profits is going to end human civilization. And their shareholders clearly went, oh, dead on, that's fine. Will it provide us with some dividends in the meantime? So the people are interested here. What's the role of the stock market, the fossil and the, you know, the capital markets in relation to fossil fuel companies? Are stock markets, do we require getting rid of the stock market? And shouldn't these kind of investment decisions be made by us democratically rather than by these private interests, I suppose, if we're going to save our planet?
That's what it comes down to, is in the major investment decisions that affect our lives. But the relationship to the stock market, fossil fuel companies directly account for only about 6% of the global stock market, which is still massive in real terms. Like, and we all know about the fucking destruction that 6% has been able to cause to the planet and to humanity. When you take into account carbon intensive and carbon reliant industries, you know, they make up a much bigger share of the stock market, you know, and much bigger share of the economy. So not just fossil fuel companies, but all of those carbon intensive and carbon reliant industries that need to either change or be tackled in a serious way. I mean, the stock market is important because when it comes to climate action, because it reflects the sort of perceived value, and it's just perceived value of those assets. The dividends that they might yield. And that in turn determines whether those companies, those assets are investable, you know, whether people are going to invest in them. Now, the value of fossil fuel companies can be affected by a whole load of things. But even if you look at the overall impact of the Paris Agreement and the reports of the IPCC, which you've mentioned, they've made it very clear, amongst other things, that 80% of the world's remaining fossil fuels just need to stay in the ground. And that's it. For us to stand under 1.5 degrees warming. What's left of the other 20% in reserves just can't be used, right? That's the bottom line. That's what has to happen. Now, as a result of those declarations, for example, this is just one example, $400 billion was wiped off the value of fossil fuel companies in the stock market over 4 years. $400 billion. Now, but there are other things propping up the value of fossil fuel companies. I think that's why it's important to look at the stock market, but the whole infrastructure, financial infrastructure around it, other things propping up the value of fossil fuel companies. Quantitative easing, for example, the fossil fuel companies fucking weighed in heavily whenever these massive quantitative easing programs came about, because they sort of know their writing's on the wall, but they don't give a shit. They're going to weigh in, take what they can, pay the dividends, boost the share prices while they can. So quantitative easing. There's access fossil fuel companies have access to massive amounts of unregulated credit through the shadow banking system. And of course, as you say, Ireland plays a major role in that. Like, Ireland is a facilitator of ecological destruction when you look at the role of its financial system. Weak regulation, of course, allows for the value of fossil fuel companies to maintain, I suppose. Then there's a whole range of greenwashing initiatives at an international and national level. So it's really important to look at the stock market, how it relates to fossil fuel companies and climate change. But we have to look at the whole infrastructure around it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I remember last year when they started the new quantitative easing programs and the direct monetary financing and all the money that's been shoved in the stock market, as we said last time when we met, to artificially, you know, keep the prices and asset values and stock market inflated. The fossil fuel companies, as you said, who had their arms in the till right up to the elbow. Stuart, do you want to come in on that at all? The relationship between the stock market, investment patterns and fossil fuel companies and what we're going to do with them?
Yeah, I'm going to give some rare good news here, actually, breaking the habits of a political lifetime. When you look at the value of share offerings in these fossil fuel producing and related companies, they dropped by $123 billion in the last decade, underperforming a key world equities index by 52%. On the other hand, share issuances by electric utilities, mainly those focused on renewable energy, etc., they've outperformed both their utility peers and the general market, and they gained $111 billion. So these shares are becoming less and less popular. People are basically beginning to realize that the time is up for some of these companies, and one of the reasons why the companies are going to be aggressively pursuing an anti-climate change agenda, saying it's all lies, etc., etc. The Anthropocene people did some survey. I'll put these up later on. I'll show the source for these later. You can use whenever you issue the podcast if you want. Investing in a stock market without fossil fuels could yield pretty much the same returns as investing in the market that includes the fossil fuel companies, according to a new analysis. So you don't need to invest in these guys. And if you do, you'll probably take a bit of a dip compared to the rest of the market. So this could be a case where rarely the stock market could work for good, because it will make these people less popular because the sentiment is against them.
Would some of that be a result of the disinvestment campaigns, or is it more just cultural than that, or are the disinvestment campaigns actually having an impact?
I think the disinvestment campaigns have had some impact, but I think it's primarily the fact that they don't think there's much money left in these companies. Their time has come. The wind is blowing against them, albeit a very, very increasingly warm wind, and they're going to have to do something about this. So I think it's that. So this is a way where the stock market can reflect sentiment and hopefully work for good. I still think we have no real capitalist way out of this crisis, and we need to do something about it much more directly.
Yeah, agreed. And talking about no capitalist way out of this crisis, let's go on to our next question, because it relates back to what we've been talking about in terms of disinvestment and intervention in the stock market. Now, we've seen most interventions in the stock market by states are, of course, to facilitate the transfer of wealth from labor to capital, or to prop up the asset values of the capitalist class. But someone's asked a question here, and I'll just read out, what the fuck is China up to in its stock market? Which is a good question, because I know that the Alliance for Workers' Liberty will be currently pulling out their teeth with rusty pliers, because we're talking about China here, and not in a negative way. And I know there's a bigger question to be discussed here about the Chinese road to socialism, which I believe they've said is 2049. And that's definitely going to be the basis of a future podcast, I think. But the specifics of the question here were about what was China doing in its stock market. I remember distinctly in 2015, because I remember referring to it in our political economy work, that China had suddenly suspended trading on 50% of all the stocks listed on its internal and international stock markets, because prices at that time were like 100 times more than forward earnings. You know what I mean? So there's no way that people were getting the dividends from the shares they bought, they thought they were getting. And so China stepped in. And then last year, I think it was the end of 2020, the Politburo vowed to end what it called a disorderly expansion of capital. And since then, of course, they've cracked down quite strongly on different sectors of their own economy. The one that was really interesting to me, which you think shouldn't exist in China, but that's a debate for another day, was the $100 billion industry in private tutoring in the hyper-competitive world that is China, in terms of getting kids into universities and into jobs. But they basically banned those companies, or on the verge of banning those companies, from making profits. They want to make them become non-profit, or they're not allowed to go public. They're not allowed to raise capital on the stock markets. They've banned the cryptocurrency operations, I think, in China in the last couple of weeks. They're talking about clamping down on property speculation as well. So what is going on in China? Is this just like uber Keynesian regulation of a market that's out of control, or is there something more here? I'll go to you first, Sean.
Yeah, it's a big one.
It's a fucking massive one.
Well, the size of the Chinese stock market is still relatively small in international terms. It's about 5% of the global total compared to the US stock market, which is something like half or 55% of the total stock market globally. But it is definitely important to look at the example of China, because it's, let's face it, China's on course to be the dominant economic and geopolitical power. As you said, there is that debate on whether China's moving in a capitalist direction, whether it's socialist or something in between. And that's a debate that can be had. But I suppose from the Communist Party's perspective, I think what they're saying, or what they have been saying, is that in order to provide for our people and pave the way for a socialist transition, we need to develop our productive forces. That means allowing a certain degree of capitalist development, a certain degree of capital accumulation. And what that has meant is the growth of a stock market, the emergence of a big tech sector, the growth of the Chinese financial system, and so on. So I suppose the big question is, and let's come back to your point, Stevie, is whether they understand the implications of allowing this sort of logic to take hold, or these tendencies, whether they understand the implications of that. Because what we're also seeing as a result of this is the rise of a billionaire class, the emergence of big tech giants, and some of these billionaires and tech giants are in senior positions in the Communist Party. We're seeing the emergence of a shadow banking system that's bigger than the one in the US. And what I think, what I suspect, I'd be interested in Stuart's view on this, like, but what I think is that Xi Jinping and those around him, I think, at least understand the importance of taming or reeling in some of these tendencies before they get out of control. So I think that's what some of these interventions are about in the stock market directly, and in terms of they're clamping down in the big tech giants as well.
Yeah, there does seem to be a faction fight in the middle of the leadership of the party, doesn't there, between those who want to kind of free up the finance sector from state control and allow particularly unregulated cross-border capital flows, which of course is central to modern 21st century capitalism, and then those that want to see China become a full member of international finance capital. And we know exactly where that will take China. So Stuart, what do you think that's kind of on the, what's going on there in the background, this faction fight between, let's call them the Keynesians and the neoliberals?
I think it's exactly that. Yeah, the Chinese stock market is interesting from a variety of points of view. The best guy to read on this, in my opinion, is a guy called Michael Pettis, or Pettis, who works in Peking University. He's a professor there. And he writes for the FT. He's written recently that, and his view is that Beijing does have an excess of domestic savings. They don't really need to go to the stock market to finance, but he thinks they open up the financial markets in recent years, mainly to gain some international prestige for those markets and to promote global use of the renminbi, which is interesting. Now, when you look at the way the Chinese stock market works itself, if you read the financial press, they warn all the time about getting in there. There is this weird thing where Shanghai prices are often way higher than Hong Kong prices. The Hong Kong market is based around fundamentals. Are they going to grow? Are they going to go ahead and pay dividends? The Shanghai market is much more speculative. When you look at why people invest in there, it can go up and down a hell of a lot here. So when you look at what people say here, this is getting back to Pettis again, Shanghai prices reflect excess liquidity. That's why the prices are higher up there. People invest, but nobody knows much about the fundamentals of the company. All right. So in terms of the free flow of funds, Pettis again is very interesting about this. He said this would leave China with a classic developing country problem, a mismatched international balance sheet. So you get the risk that foreign investors in China could suddenly exit a time when Chinese investors put their money overseas, because a lot of Chinese people with money are going to be investing Dutch overseas. They don't want to repatriate their foreign investments quickly enough. And Pettis describes this as something we've seen many times before, a rickety financial system held together by the moral hazard of state support. It's forced to adjust to a surge in hot money inflows that can't adjust quickly enough when these turn into outflows. Now, remember here that Pettis is saying this from his position in Peking University. Either a very brave guy, or maybe state oppression in China is not quite so bad as some people try and make it out to be. But the Chinese are very aware of this. I think Xi is much more about the politics than he is about the economics. And if you do open yourself up this way, as many developing economies have done, and it's happened to some of the developing economies in Asia, Southeast Asia in particular, in the late 1990s, when things go tits up, the money will go. And that will leave you badly exposed. And the money your people have overseas, they're not going to bring that back. All right. And one of the big problems of the financial sector is they don't want to give you any money at the time when you need it most, i.e. when you have no money left. So the Chinese are very aware of all this. And interesting, too, regarding China's transition from an export-led to a domestic demand-led economy, the various factions in China are going to be against this. If you want to go ahead and move to having more domestic demand, you've got to start paying people more. If you start paying people more, then your status as the low-wage competitor in international markets goes down. So there are all sorts of issues in China with the various factions there. The stock market is a bit of a fucking mess, to be honest, yeah, and anybody investing in it is taking one hell of a big risk.
Yeah, we'll get back to that one. I know that, as you said, Sean said, that the stock market doesn't play as big a role in the Chinese economy as it does in other parts of the world. But what it does do is reveal the battles that are going on within that state and within particularly the Communist Party about what the future direction of that country should be. You know, I mean, it's only, what, 10, 15 years that some of its internal stock markets have been open to foreign investment anyway, as opposed to the ones in Hong Kong and Shanghai and so on. So it's moving, it's a kind of fast moving feast there. So we'll have to keep our eye on it, see what's interesting. But what is interesting, of course, is the debate about regulation and deregulation. There's another question coming from someone about the very battle that's going on in China about, do you deregulate markets? How do you deregulate them? And what are the results of that being? Now, obviously, the Chinese are concerned about the social instability and the social impact of deregulation and the financialization of its economy. And it should be, because all they've got to do is look around the world to see the impact of the last 30, 40 years and the massive social crises that have emerged because of what happened, particularly starting in the 70s right the way through. And what the question here, specific question here, is what did the Big Bang do for the stock markets? For those who don't know, Big Bang, October 1986. I remember it on the TV, I was still at school. And it led to a massive expansion in financial activities. It even needed more physical space in London. That's when they kind of colonized and rebuilt Canary Wharf. And I worked on the 17th floor of One Canada Square, the big tall one. My Uncle Mick got me a job there. He was head foreman. He used to walk around with a hard hat sprayed gold with Mick on the front of it. And no one fucked with Mick. So he got me a job for the summer there and I got well paid. It's all owned by US investment banks now, which tells you the result of that. But what did Stuart, I'll go to you first, mate. Sean's just texted me there. I know fuck all about the Big Bang. So we'll just go straight to Stuart and ask him what was the impact of the Big Bang? Was it a revolutionary turn in how finance capital was able to financialize the economy? Second question. Someone's also sent in, and what the fuck has the Glass-Steagall Act got to do with that?
Okay, Glass-Steagall is separate from Big Bang, but maybe related. Anyway, Big Bang, certainly in 86, historically, the stock market had a monopoly and commissions were fixed. Interestingly enough, Thatcher's privatization made a lot of people realize why stockbrokers made so much money, because the commissions were so high. So that basically accelerated the work of Sir Gordon Bury, in charge of the Office of Fair Trading, who was after the stock market for a long time. In anticipation of being sanctioned, they basically opened things up. So in the old days, you had market makers who bought and sold, and you had brokers who went to go ahead and get you.
Oh, is the market breaker a stock jobber?
Yes.
Fucking yes. I looked that up last week. I understand what it is now. Well done. Well done, me, everyone. Thank you. So go on, carry on.
And jobbers were separate. Basically, you went to your broker and said, get me 500 shares in Stevie Nolan's company. And so anybody stupid enough to do that would be taken to the stock market where they would talk to a jobber. And the jobber would make a price, the price he would buy and the price he would sell at.
And so it was Big Bang about getting rid of those jobbers, really, that intermediary kind of...
It was about ending the separation between them. So stock market companies were able, like my company, Climewatts, we bought both a broker, Greaves and Grant, and we bought a jobber, Wed Delacker. Now, the Wed Delacker guys, this is 1986, remember, I think we paid $8 million each to join, and we paid the fucking tax as well. So we took those guys on for that was the Wed Delacker 8. Greaves and Grant were a stockbroker that we bought. Remember, these companies were partnerships and the money was theirs. So when Greaves and Grant moved their furniture around to us, all the furniture fell apart in the removal process because it was so fucking old. Now, these were relatively small companies that didn't have an awful lot of capital. We suddenly gave them a huge amount of capital, and a lot of it was pissed away. So the initial elements, I guess to answer the question a bit more quickly, commissions certainly went down. Right, commissions went down a hell of a lot, no doubt about it. It became much easier to go ahead and trade in the stock market. You put together the brokers and jobbers led to a conflict of interest, which we always had, because if someone goes to stockbroker and says, I want to buy some Stevie Nolan stuff, it's in your interest for the jobbers to go ahead and say, right, that's coming in there. Let's go ahead and let's sell the stuff, right? Let's go ahead and sell Stevie Nolan stuff to anybody who wants it. Let's sell it at a good price. So there came a conflict of interest there with stockbrokers recommending the stocks which their jobbers held. Yeah, that's, I think, an ongoing issue with the way the market is ranged just now. It attracted a huge amount of money and investment to the area. If you look at that movie, I think it's called Inside Trade, they talk about a guy who was a bond dealer in the early 1970s. He had to have a second job to make ends meet. By the end of the 80s, things were significantly different because of deregulation and the huge amount of money from the big banks that came into the market. Glass-Steagall was the act put in place by two senators, I think must have been in the early 1930s, which prevented regular banks from pissing about investing in stocks and shares. So Glass-Steagall ensured that separation. By 1999, Glass-Steagall was effectively dead, given various regulatory tweaks, and in that year, it was finally abolished. So then the big banks were able to go ahead and take positions and buy companies that speculated in securities.
All of these stories, of course, and all of these changes are part of that 40-year deregulation of capital markets starting in the early 1970s, following the end of the gold standard, I suppose, and freeing up particularly capital flows across nations with the end of capital controls. And it's a really complicated story that we try and tell it in our political economy, but it's not a linear, simple narrative. It's quite a chaotic story, actually, when you try and look into that deregulation. It wasn't as if they sat, the neoliberals, with a big plan all mapped out and a blueprint of how they were going to deregulate. It happened in fits and starts, didn't it, and bits and bobs here and there. But the ultimate aim, of course, is the world we have now, which is one in which, as you said, our economy is increasingly financialized, and there is incredible power at the hands of the people who are investing in and making investment decisions in the stock market. That's the ultimate role, isn't it? And the state's role simply is to get out of the way and to facilitate that, I suppose.
Which they certainly did, yeah, because the state, I mean, remember the Tory party is 50% financed by the financial sector, and the rest of it probably comes from property developers.
There's another debate we had there, maybe again, about that. There wasn't that during the Brexit debate about that that faction fight that took place between the British capitalist class as well, between the financiers and between the manufacturers, between the ones who are interested in, you know, the car industry and the ones who are just interested in getting their hands of luck on more investments and keeping their assets high. So that's an interesting debate there about that faction fight between the ruling classes and who won that one out. So maybe we can revisit, because obviously none of that debate took place during the debate about Brexit.
No, not at all. Sorry, one more thing about the Big Bang. One effect which I don't think they expected was an increased monopolization of the industry. Most of the old names disappeared at the time. Some of the bigger banks like Warburg's, huge merchant bank, our big competitors at the time, they just disappeared. Kleinwort Benson, my own company, was bought by Dresdner Bank. And one of the problems that we had after Big Bang was nobody made any money. All right, we had a good year in 86. After that, the stockbroking part of the industry continually lost money. It wasn't until 1993, when the market moved in a very unusual way, that the big stockbroking firms actually made any cash, and eventually some consolidation had to go ahead and take place. So that was one more aspect of Big Bang. Something that was supposed to go ahead and take on monopoly actually led to a smaller number of firms controlling the market.
But I think there's something to be looked at in more depth here. Kind of, there's an idea forming in my head here about how neoliberalism has shaped the globe and how the stock market's played a role in that, particularly in the idea of deregulation and capital flows across the globe, and how it's made everything that much more unstable for everybody. There's so much of the global markets and so many jobs are dependent on decisions made in places that we have, you know, that are kind of hidden from us. I think we'll go back to that one. Sean, did you want to come in on that or on the Big Bang? Have you been furiously studying there in the background, or have you got some...
no. I know what the Big Bang was, but I wasn't aware of the full impacts of it, you know, other than the sort of financial system that we have today, centered on the City of London. But I think it'd be interesting to look at that, to look at those some of those processes of deregulation and opening up capital flows and all that sort of stuff, and plug some of those historical gaps.
Yeah, it's a good one, particularly because you can compare it to what China are doing now, because they're attempting to, it's as if they're stopping halfway through their 1980s period and saying, hold on, this is far enough, we can't open up the economy any more than we have done. All right, lads, we'll definitely get back to that one. I think there's a job to be done in describing that deregulation process from the 70s right the way through, you know, and the results of it. I've got another question here. We've got about another 5 minutes, 5 or 7 minutes left here. This other question that comes through here. And now we've had a lot of discussion on our podcast with Stuart's help and other people, Sean and John Barry come in to help us with it, on modern monetary theory, on the nature of money itself. There's probably more work to be done on that one, but we've had a lot of discussion about state finances and what debt is and tax, and a lot of that debate, of course, goes back to, and as I said before, send our listeners off to look at the end of the gold standard back in 1971 when the world of money irrevocably changed when Nixon broke the link between dollar and gold, and overnight almost, you know, the gold standard disappeared and fiat money emerged. And for those that don't know, fiat money simply means money that has no intrinsic commodity value apart from what you're willing to pay for it. If that's the case, and it is the case, and the world of finance obviously massively changed when you're dealing with fiat money as opposed to money linked to a commodity like gold, someone's asking the questions, if that's the case, why do states want gold reserves? Why do they hold on to them? Why did Germany at the end of the crash in 2008 repatriate all of its gold? And what the fuck was German gold doing in other people's countries anyway? So what's that link? Is it as simple as that people feel more secure, like countries feel more secure if they've got a few bit of gold bullion in their vaults? It's a weird concept when you're dealing with this opaque, chaotic stock market on the one hand, full of fiat money, which people think isn't real money. Of course it is. But and then this kind of old fashioned concept of bullion. What's the story there, Stuart? Give people some insight into that.
Going back to my old company, Climeworks, again, we had a bullion broker, Sharps Pixley, which never made any money. And I think in the end, we sold sometime in the late 1980s. In 1980, the world went completely tits up. The dollar crashed. And when the dollar goes down, where do you put your money into to go ahead and keep it safe? Gold. And Sharps Pixley, who made maybe a couple of £100,000 every year, something as low as that, made 26 million. So gold does have some intrinsic value in various industrial processes, as does silver. And when you look at the Australian dollar, that's actually quite closely connected to the price of gold, because Australia is primarily an extractive economy. But it's basically it's a last resort. So people expected gold to rise a little bit more recently. It hasn't, because people expect the stock market to rise. And that's where you have a bit of a disconnect historically. If this had happened, say, 30 odd years ago, the price of gold would have gone up.
Is it as simple as that if there's a massive worldwide global financial crash, countries think they can just like revert to a gold standard or something? Is that what it's back to?
I don't know so much as that. It's just that historically people have invested in gold, and the price of gold has gone up whenever everything else has gone tits up.
But it's pretty fucking stupid, isn't it? If there's a proper global financial crash, I mean, and we saw it during COVID, we saw the kind of echo of this during COVID. If there's supply chain crashes and products disappear, and products that people need, medical products and health products and fucking food products, what the fuck is gold going to do for us? I mean, at that point, you know, you'll be in such a shit that there'll be no food on the shelves in the supermarkets. I mean, that's where a big global financial crash could head quite quickly in terms of supply chains, but now being so sophisticated and so extended across the globe, the gold's not really going to do you any good, is it? Is it just a cultural thing there that we like to think that we have this bullion in a bank? And is it as basic as that?
I think it's that, and given the fact historically gold has been the investment of last resort. So it's getting back, I guess, to that t-shirt you see people wear with the Native American proverb, you can't eat money and you can't eat gold, certainly. But in the past, it's proven to be a pretty good hedge.
There's a really interesting story there, actually, because I was reading that book again, a brilliant book by David Graeber, and he talks about the idea that if you want to understand the last couple of thousand years of human civilization, it's the link, he says, or the flows between credit and bullion. And if you want to understand world history, particularly the development of capitalism, he says, it was in the 1480s that we slid back into bullion, the discovery of the Americas, and literally the existence of gold and silver in parts of the world, particularly in Central and South America. And he says, now we've gone back into the credit age. He says, but you know, there's nothing to say that, particularly with the climate crisis and the kind of crisis we're facing, we won't slide back into a bullion age where actually gold and silver and commodities become the base of all economic activity. Sean, did you want to come in on that one? It's an interesting one for me. I'm fascinated by that whole concept of commodity versus fiat money.
Yeah, there seem to be two reasons for countries looking to repatriate their gold in recent years. There was a big gold repatriation spree, I suppose, just prior to the pandemic. I think you mentioned it earlier, Stevie, that the global economy was already heading into a downturn and things are looking really uncertain. And there's a big spree of, you know, repatriation involving China and Turkey and Hungary and a load of other countries across Eastern Europe. The basic economic reason, and I suppose it is irrational, but is that we were living in uncertain economic times and gold's usually seen as a safe bet.
Mm.
But I think there's something else going on in geopolitical terms. The neoliberal international order is breaking down. It was breaking down prior to the pandemic, but it's certainly the case now. You're seeing trade wars and protectionism and all sorts of stuff, you know, related to those competing national economic agendas, which is a definite shift towards competition between national economies and national ruling classes. You have countries that are beginning to challenge hegemony, not just China, but in other parts of the world. And I think part of the repatriation of gold is also asserting their economic sovereignty and moving away from that sort of system dominated by the US. And then in turn, or in response, I suppose, gold plays a role for the old imperial powers, who can use gold as a form of economic terrorism. And we've seen that in, I think it was 2018 or 19, when the Maduro government in Venezuela was facing a coup and decided to try to repatriate its gold from Britain. And the British government obstructed it, prevented it from happening. I think it was something to the tune of $2 billion worth of gold, which you know, would have served a really useful purpose for the Venezuelan government at the time. But the British prevented it as a means of exacerbating the crisis that the Britain and the US and the West had created in order to oust the Maduro government. So it still plays a major role in geopolitical terms, and I think that'll continue to be the case as long as all the major reserves are held in the likes of the US.
Yeah, it's fascinating the kind of parallel existence of this credit fiat money world and this bullion world, and how reading what's happening and the relationship between the two of them tells you an awful lot about imperialism and global politics is something we'll definitely have to return to. And if you haven't read David Graeber's book yet, listeners, on 5,000 years of debt, you really should. It's a great introduction to understanding the world of money, the world of credit. Stuart, you want to pop in there? We've only got a couple of minutes left, mate, so away you go.
Very quickly, regarding the gold standard, the interesting thing is that the euro is effectively the new gold standard. In the old days, when currencies were linked to gold at a fixed rate, if you overinflated, say, and you had problems with your balance of payments, then the only adjustment was austerity, because your exchange rate couldn't decline in line with your lack of relative competitiveness. One of the reasons why the gold standard was a disaster in the 1920s when Britain returned to it, and why it caused problems again up until 1971. Talking about repatriation, remember, I think de Gaulle repatriated quite a huge amount of gold from Fort Knox, which did help undermine the system. So gold can be used because of its physical qualities as a weapon. Right now, there's no gold involved, but because the gold standard means fixed exchange rates, and that has got an inbuilt deflationary element to it, the euro is the new gold standard and should be condemned 100% as such.
Nice one. And we'll do that and we'll revisit. There's definitely another part to be had on the euro as well, in the eurozone, and how it controls and influences the economies of the European region. Right, we've got one question left. It's a quick one. I don't think, Sean, you can answer this one. I know that we call Sean in the office Dick Whittington. He's only been to London once. And so the question is, and the question refers to the London culture, and it's just as how stock exchange players make their money. How do they make their money? Why are they paid so much? And are they all posh cocaine-snorting twats? And that comes from, I'm not going to tell you who sent that question in, but Stuart, that one's to you, because you lived in that culture, you worked in that culture. Is what we see on The Wolf of Wall Street and all them other like Hollywood films true? Is there a culture there of those kinds of, let's call them wankers? Considering you're friends with lots of them, you're being careful what you say.
I'm not so much anymore. Remember, there are many people in the city who do a proper, decent sort of job. I actually moved myself from the more casino side of the business to regular international trade finance, which was, you know, basically financing smaller companies' working capital requirements. Unfortunately, as a species, we become like the people around us. So if you end up getting a job in the casino element of the stock market, especially if you work for someone like Goldman Sachs or some of the big bulge bracket firms like that, you'll be surrounded by arrogant wankers who probably do take an awful lot of cocaine. Mind you, a lot of working class people take cocaine as well these days. Cocaine doesn't make anybody into a nicer person. So the simple answer is, the city is more complicated than that. If you work on that investment banking bullshit side of the market, then yeah, all right, there's a good chance you're going to end up a cocaine-snorting twat. I don't have any friends left from that period. I did meet some people in that side of the market who weren't wankers, but I can't count them on. I can't remember too many of them. The answer to why they make so much money, size, absolutely enormous size of the stock market there, and the size of the surplus being investment. I think hedge funds charge 1.4% management fee and a 16.4% management fee, the most recent figures I saw, which is down from previous figures there. But when you look at the size of the funds they're investing, it's fucking huge. And bear in mind too, most fund managers, 80% actually underperform the FTSE. So as some would say, money and a lot of money for old rope.
Yeah, well, we'll get into that one as well in terms of, because shadow banking and these are another couple of things that have come in only in the last few days in terms of what is shadow banking, someone asked Sean, and also someone asked, can we hear more about hedge funds? Because you hear them all the time. No one seems to know what they are. They seem to be extremely powerful. The head of hedge funds seem to be extremely powerful individuals as well, many of whom, of course, are donating money to political parties, a Tory party in Britain. But so we'll certainly have a look at the hedge funds, hedge fund managers, and what their role and the role of shadow banking, which, of course, is linked to deregulation, deregulation of banking and finance, that allow these shadow banks, the clues in the title, that allow them to exist and to operate. That, lads, is the end of this podcast. Our two introductory podcasts are done. From here, we move on to looking at some core concepts and maybe a little bit more detail to give everyone what we're going to be talking about next time. Just an idea of what we're going to be talking about next time. We're looking a little bit, we think, at money, debt, credit. We looked at that a little bit today, mentioned it, the idea of, you know, fiat money versus bullion. People want to know the difference between a stock and a share. Are they the same thing? Where did shares emerge? The concept, the infrastructure of them. The bond market, people want to know what that is. What are bonds? What's the bond market? People have asked for what the fuck is Forex? Sean mentioned that in episode one. What is the currency market? Is it linked to LIBOR? People also want to know the old classics. What are derivatives? Have they been around long? What is a share buyback? What is securitization? So it's an awful lot, lads, to get our heads into and get our heads around and do it in a way that we explain it to people who don't know what this stuff is. Not that fucking I know what this stuff is, but we're making the effort to demystify some of this stuff for you. So hopefully we'll get onto that next time, lads. And if anyone's listening wants to know anything else about the stock market, send us in a wee email or DM or something on our Twitter or Facebook, and we'll do our best to add it to the long list of concepts and themes that we're going to be investigating. All right, lads, are you happy?
I think so.
Right. Okay, then look, we'll see you all again next time. Take it easy. Slagle foil. That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and slagle foil.